She is a ball of fire. She could have negotiated a better Iran deal than John Kerry did. She has a big personality, she's strong, and she knows what she wants. When she was four, I said, Yards, come sit next to me in this chair. Let's have a conversation. No, she said. Well, that's rude, I said, kidding her. What's also annoying, she said, is you telling me how rude I am. Another time, she agreed to stop sucking her thumb. I saw her go for the thumb that night. Yards, I thought you were going to work on not sucking your thumb, I said. I am, she said, but not today. Or tomorrow. Yardley will run around the living room 50 times before sitting down. The same thing she enjoyed as a baby when my mom would visit and stroll a crying Yardley around and around our dining room table into the wee hours. At school, Doug and I have made it clear that we don't want them to discipline that energy out of her. I have very few worries about Yardley, because it's clear she will take life by the reins. Yards is also very loving, just like Yates. Often I wake up to her gently kissing my forehead. My one friend used to wake up to her child lifting up her eyelids. I thought, my God, that sounds awful. I'm grateful that my daughter eases me into the day instead. Not long ago, she saw me crying at her preschool graduation. Why are you crying, Mama? She asked. They're tears of joy, honey. And now, when she sees me well up, she'll ask, are those joy of tears? I love that. Joy of tears. Because that's true, too. She sometimes reminds me of a pro wrestler. She is freakishly strong, as is my sister, Suzanne. If you need a jar opened or a dresser moved, they're your girls. That trait skipped me, but Yards has the gift. She can pick any of us up and constantly tries to. Her younger brother doesn't particularly enjoy Yardley hauling him around, but it's his own fault for being so cute and portable. Yardley and Yates have a special relationship. Once, she asked him, Yates, are we friends? Yates looked over at her. We're brother and sister, Yards, but we're also friends. With Yardley, I took another 4-month maternity leave. Unlike America's Newsroom, this leave was different, because I knew I'd be returning to this anchor post. I worried a bit. Would the viewers forget about me? Would my ratings dip while I was out? I decided not to sweat that, to just focus on my children and see what happened. Lo and behold, we used fill-in anchors and the world kept turning on its axis. My job was still there waiting for me after my leave was over. And why? Because I was good at it. They wanted me in the chair. All that time I could have spent asking for opportunities, I had channeled instead into getting better. The work paid off. My job was secure. Returning to America Live after Yardley was, as it had been with Yates, hard. But I muddled through. One of the things about TV is, you have to play hurt, and you have to do it convincingly. You can't go out and mope on the job. On my first day back, I had a spirited back and forth with radio host Mike Gallagher that attracted a lot of attention. He knew I wanted to discuss his attack on my maternity leave, which he had publicly mocked while I was out. I respected that he showed up, knowing we were going there. Is maternity leave, according to you, a racket? I asked him on the air. Well, do men get maternity leave? He said, with a jocular smile on his face. Guess what? Yes, they do, I shot back with a grin. It's called the Family and Medical Leave Act. Indeed, if men would like to take 3 months off to care for their newborn babies, they can, thanks to the law signed by Bill Clinton. As for women, I pointed out, the United States is the only country in the advanced world that doesn't require paid maternity leave. Some companies simply offer it because they know it's the right thing to do. Others are forced to offer unpaid leave, thanks to the FMLA. Still others have no policy at all. A staggering 1 in 4 new moms return to work after just 2 weeks maternity leave. That is seriously wrong. I wanted to know what it was about carrying a baby for 9 months and then giving birth that Gallagher didn't think warranted a few months off, so bonding and recovery can take place. Having had 2 babies by this point, I was amused at his notion that maternity leave was somehow a vacation. Up all night, nursing a newborn, breasts in pain, sleep-deprived, physically depleted, completely exhausted, with 0 time to even shower. It didn't feel much like a trip to the Bahamas. It was a good-natured exchange. Gallagher's a good guy, but he knew I had him. I heard from viewers that the exchange opened a few eyes on the issue. And yet, that staunch defender of liberal principles, John Stewart, apparently took offense. Can you say Fox derangement syndrome? Stewart went on the air a night later and offered a lengthy hit piece, criticizing my push for better maternity leave for women. To say his presentation was dishonest would be a gross understatement. Stewart played earlier clips of me appearing to question things like food stamps, suggesting that I was against any entitlements except ones that might benefit me. This was way off base. For one thing, as a news anchor, I would never take a position favoring or opposing entitlements. I get paid to play devil's advocate. This is my job. It's pretty straightforward. Moreover, Stewart's assertion that I was pushing for government-mandated maternity leave, i.e. an entitlement, assumes too much. Maybe I'm for that, maybe I'm not. I've never said publicly, and I'm not about to here. But touting the value of paid leave does not necessarily mean support for any government involvement. It could mean we ought to pressure employers to voluntarily offer this benefit, as mine does, which has been proven to help families and to attract and retain top female talent. And finally, the notion that advocating for paid leave would somehow benefit me was absurd. I work for Fox News. My deals are by contract. No policies need to be changed for me to get paid maternity leave, nor is it generally people in positions like mine for whom this is an issue. I have bargaining power, and I'm also well paid. Many are not so fortunate. Stewart used to attack me fairly often during America Live. I spent far too much time worrying about these hits. I was young and still apprehensive of him. I feared that his attacks, however unfounded, were going to hurt me. He was very beloved. And disturbingly, he was the primary news source for millions of young people, men in particular. Abby grew to loathe him. "I'm a comic," he would say, when people tried to talk to him about his role in the media or his journalistic responsibility. But that was a cop-out. He wanted to be taken seriously on many issues, and he was, and he knew he was, as when he laudably advocated for 9/11 first responders. But he wanted to deny that reality when it suited him to do so. One time on the air, I jokingly called Stewart mean. He picked up the phone and called me. He had me on the phone for over an hour, wanting to know why I thought he was mean. I told him that he took things out of context. "We do not," he said. "You absolutely do, all the time," I said. "Give me an example." I gave him the example of the hit piece on my maternity leave. "No," he said, "I had you on that. Totally self-serving. Absolutely wrong." I pointed out the fallacy of his argument, including the fact that my maternity leave was set by contract, and I needed no government mandate to get it. He did not back down. "You would benefit," he said, "because you would get psychic income from knowing your comments helped people." It was like arguing with Jell-O. We agreed to disagree, but he seemed genuinely bothered by the notion that I would think him dishonest or mean-spirited. "This feels like you've sinned," I said, "and you want absolution. Well, I'm not giving it. You're like the class bully." "How?" he wanted to know. "Because you love to pick on news people who can't respond." "What do you mean you can't respond?" he said. "You have a show." "I'm not Bill O'Reilly," I explained to him. "I'm a journalist. Most of the people you hit are journalists. What are we going to do? Take time away from talking about Syria to address something on Comedy Central? Am I going to have my news team waste their time pulling more complete clips to prove that your cherry-picked clips are wrong? That's not what news people do. We don't have the staff or the platforms for that. We're trying to actually report the news." Stewart and I did have one funny exchange in the call he made to me. "You are the one person at Fox News I actually respect," he confessed toward the end in an apparent moment of weakness. "I hate myself for loving that," I responded in a weak moment of my own. We talked a bit about our lives, our kids, our spouses. He spoke about his wife and her pregnancies. "Just so you know," I said, "I was sitting on the couch nursing my newborn baby when I saw your latest hit piece on me. Good times." "Not listening," he said. "La la 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 la, don't humanize yourself. La la la." I laughed, and we moved on. Not friends, exactly, but not enemies, either. In retrospect, the Stewart bits don't bother me at all. But they were a wake-up call that I was now subject to a whole new level of scrutiny, and that I'd better be ready if I was going to make it in this business. I had put myself out there. Public scrutiny is part of the job. I had two choices: stop actually feeling wounded, or acknowledge the difficulty and not let it dilute the content of my message. Either way, sitting around feeling sorry for myself was not an option. I was learning how to do my job under fire, how to be a mother under fire. My children need me, regardless of what's happening in my professional life, and my viewers do too. Sad about leaving your baby? Smile and do the news. Worried about Jon Stewart trying to ruin your career? Smile and do the news. How did I do that? I remembered who I was. These people didn't define me, nor did they control me. Hell, they didn't even know me. With every hit I'd take, I felt that I was getting stronger. Yep, still standing. Here I am, right here. Functioning in the face of adversity may not be fun, but it is a strength. It wasn't easy, but with practice, and I had plenty, I developed some grit. Hell, I had walked around the Upper West Side of Manhattan with my baby in a Fox News onesie. I could handle this. Stewart's attack on my maternity leave segment didn't hamper my willingness to engage in strong discussions about women. Just a few months after that attack, Bill O'Reilly and I went head-to-head on sexism. He had told Judge Jeanine Pirro to calm down on his show, as she was making an entirely legitimate argument. I was on a day later. "It's patronizing," I told him. "And it has a special connotation when a man says it to a woman on top of that." Seriously, few things are as irritating as being told to calm down. It's paternalistic, like a pat on the head. In April 2016, the Reverend Al Sharpton tried telling me to calm down. "Watch it," I warned him, and when he pleaded ignorance as to why, I suggested he speak to O'Reilly. Chapter 16. Now Everyone's Here. The first big election event Brett and I co-anchored together was the 2010 midterm elections. It was a big night as Republicans seized control of the U.S. House 2 years into Barack Obama's presidency. However, it was child's play compared to 2 years later. From presidential debates to wall-to-wall convention coverage, Brett and I were in the middle of it all. By election night 2012, we were ready for anything. Thank God, because boy, did we get it. As the show was about to begin, the excitement in the studio built. Fox had rented a helicopter to shoot beauty shots of Times Square, and the Fox News logo lit up the buildings. The presidency would be decided tonight, and we knew we'd have well over 10 million viewers watching. Brett and I stood before the cameras as the clock ticked down to the big show open. I looked at Brett and said, "This is quite a moment." He gave me a fist bump, and we were off. Despite weeks of people like Dick Morris and Karl Rove and some pollsters like Scott Rasmussen telling us Mitt Romney was likely to win, it soon became clear that he would not. And yet Rove, a Fox News contributor and former George W. Bush guru, sat next to me at the anchor desk, arguing that the numbers, even that night, were pointing toward a Romney win. Based on the returns we had at hand, Rove's claim appeared, frankly, impossible. I had seen Rove do this with the numbers in the past. It seemed like he could take any poll and spin it however he liked. It was a skill, really, and he was quite good at it. This is the man who got George W. Bush elected twice to the presidency. Say what you will about him, there's a reason they call him the architect. He started pulling that on our set, and I asked him flat out, "Is this just math you do as a Republican to make yourself feel better, or is this real?" Stewart and others would make a lot out of that moment, as if I were taunting Rove, but I was genuinely trying to make sense of what he was saying. But the fun with Rove was not over yet. The time came that evening when the Fox News decision desk was ready to call Ohio for Barack Obama. Now, the decision desk is a group of nerdy, lovable number crunchers who, whatever their personal political affiliation, have one mission and one mission only: to call the race correctly. Calling Ohio for President Obama meant one thing: the election was his, and Romney had lost. The enormity of this moment was not lost on the decision desk. They told me later they went around the table one by one, asking each man to raise his hand if he agreed with the call. It was unanimous. Ohio would be called, as would the presidency, and the 2012 race was over. So imagine our surprise at the anchor desk when Karl Rove challenged the call, suggesting it was too early to call Ohio based on the results he was seeing. Brett and I looked at Carl. We looked at each other. "That's awkward," I said on the air, acknowledging the reality of the situation. It was clear what needed to be done, and we did it. We pulled back the curtain, figuratively speaking, and I marched down to the decision desk and got some clarity. We let the whole thing play out live on the air, inviting the viewers in on the electric moment. My walk out of the studio and down the hallway was seen by tens of millions of people around the globe. It was easily the most watched, most exciting TV moment of election night 2012, and we knew at the time that it was a big deal. I remember saying to two of the decision desk guys, Arnon Mishkin and Chris Seierwalt, "You realize, of course, this is going to be everywhere tomorrow." They knew. On camera, I questioned them both about the call, and of course they stood by their decision, providing the logic and reasoning behind it. Thrust from a post behind the scenes to a moment on camera before an audience of millions, the guys remained completely unflustered. They had confidence in their judgment. Barack Obama had won Ohio and had been reelected President of the United States. It was a big moment for Fox News, and it was heralded by some unusual fans in the press the next day. None other than the New York Times' David Carr wrote about that moment in a story called, "For One Night at Fox, News Tops Agenda." Having worked at Fox News for so many years, I was used to the veiled shots in any compliment from the mainstream press. We received dozens of requests for interviews with me in the days that followed, almost all of which we turned down. I wondered at the time just how lasting a moment this would be in the national memory of election coverage. Steierwalt and I had a drink later with the rest of the gang at a bar near Fox, debriefing about the night. "So," I said, "Obama wins." "Journalism wins," Steierwalt responded. We raised our glasses and drank. Right after that election, I got pregnant with Thatcher. I remember talking about the possibility of having a third child with my dear friend Janice Dean. We both understood it would be tough to manage. Three kids, a busy career, another pregnancy on air. I thought, maybe I shouldn't. I'm doing well here. Will this interfere? It didn't matter. I knew I wanted another baby. I said to Janice and to myself, "We cannot make decisions about our children based on what works for Fox. We have to do what works for us." And what worked for me was to bring my third child into the world. I knew he was waiting for me and Doug to go get him. So we did. I was newly pregnant when the terrible events of Newtown, Connecticut happened. It was one of only two times I've ever had to visibly choke back tears on the air. I hadn't revealed that I was pregnant. And that story, oh, that devastating story, it was more than any human being could take. Later that night at home, Doug and I were talking about it. Yeats was only three, and I was so thankful I did not have to explain it to him, that he was too young to understand. Still, he overheard us talking in code. He looked at us and heard a new word. "What means hate?" he asked. I will never forget that moment. A year later, I would invite several of the Newtown family members onto the show to discuss smart gun and mental health policies. I gave them each a book Doug's own family had read faithfully in the months after Doug's father had passed. It's called Healing After Loss, and its daily meditations and prayers can provide some comfort to those in deep mourning. The months passed, my pregnancy progressed, and I got bigger, in more ways than one. My career was thriving. My kids were thriving, too. I felt torn, of course, between my work and my kids, and knew I needed more time with both on any given day. What I definitely did not need was a lecture from three men on how my career was terrible for my kids. Fox Business host Lou Dobbs had invited two guests, conservative commentator Eric Erickson and liberal pundit Juan Williams, onto his show to discuss a report from the Pew Research Center that said women have become the breadwinners in 40% of households with children. These guys were complaining publicly that this trend was one of the horsemen of the apocalypse. They really had been saying some crazy things on Fox Business about how damaging it was for children to have their mothers working, and how women were more the submissive type while men were really the dominant ones. You can imagine how I felt watching this while at home with two young children and a third on the way. This is, as an aside, one of the beautiful things about diversity in the workforce. In this case, having a working mom as an anchor. The workforce is then not monolithic, and different viewpoints can be aired. I asked them both to come on my show and say that same stupid stuff. To their credit, they did. My first question for Eric was, what makes you dominant and me submissive, and who died and made you scientist-in-chief? It's good to kick things off with a bang. Feminists were saying that men's and women's roles were interchangeable, Eric said, and that isn't healthy for society. He claimed he wasn't judging anybody, but that science supported his view that men should be the breadwinners and women should raise the children. I told him he clearly was judging people. I pointed out that his so-called science was wrong and his facts were wrong, and pulled out a raft of studies to prove it. Lou spoke for a long time, agreeing with Eric that society's ills had a lot to do with women in the workforce. I interrupted him to ask if he really meant that. He got irritated. Let me finish what I'm saying, if I may, oh dominant one. Excuse me? I replied with a raised eyebrow. I wound up rattling off study after study showing that they were wrong about children of working mothers. I noted that this was the same thing they used to say about the children of interracial marriages to discourage people from marrying across racial lines, that mixing black and white would be detrimental to the child's success. Tell that to Barack Obama, I said. Erickson later said publicly that the exchange really made him think. He admitted that he had been wrong on this subject and believed he should be more careful in what he said, especially as the father of a young daughter. I give him a ton of credit for that. It is hard for any of us to admit when we're wrong, never mind so publicly. He and I have remained friendly throughout the years. That segment was also the beginning of my friendship with Sheryl Sandberg, who called me up after seeing it and said, I love you. We had a long talk, the first of many, and she has become an inspiring force to me. I love how her brand of feminism highlights the things we can all agree on as women: empowerment, advancement, equality, sisterhood, and steers clear of the more divisive issues. I told her I am not a feminist. Sheryl, one of the preeminent female role models in America, passed no judgment on my feelings about that term. An example for our younger generation, some of whom openly booed me on Stephen Colbert's Late Show one time for saying I do not consider myself a feminist. I almost scolded the young women then and there. Is there no room for ambivalence about that term? We need more women in this sisterhood tent, not less. Who gives a damn what label we use so long as we are living a life that supports other women? My problem with the word feminist is that it's exclusionary and alienating. I look at a lot of the self-titled feminists in this country and think, if that's the club we're talking about, I don't want in. Feminism has become associated de facto with liberal politics. Call me crazy, but Gloria Steinem proudly wearing an I had an abortion t-shirt might be a little off-putting to some. This is not to take a position on abortion. It's just to ask, why do we have to make the most divisive issues a key part of the feminist platform? Wouldn't we do better to simply unite on female empowerment? I also reject the feminist messaging that treats gender issues as a zero-sum game, that assumes that to empower women, we must castrate men. You see the beginnings of this even in the schoolyard, with affirmations like, girls rule and boys drool. As the mother of two boys and the wife of a loving, supportive man, I object. I don't want Yardley's empowerment to come at the expense of my sons. Isn't that what we've been complaining about men doing to us? Sheryl and I talked about everything. Our husbands, our careers, and our kids. We had both taught aerobics in college, it turned out. Both married strong, evolved men. And both had high-powered jobs in male-dominated industries. Yes, she went to the actual Harvard, and I went to the Harvard of Albany, but why must every detail be parsed? We, of course, had no idea that day that Sheryl's husband Dave would die in a tragic accident just 3 years later. The event would change the lives of Sheryl and her two children forever, and would sadly give us yet another thing in common: the sudden, premature death of a beloved family member. A void that, no matter how much you achieve, how much you have, is always there. Always. Thatcher came along 27 months after Yardley. I call him my walking cupcake. Not like the cupcakes on our nation's campuses who need safe spaces, like a walking ball of sweetness. As Doug said when he was born, now everyone's here who's supposed to be here. We knew right away that we were done, that this was our family. Thatcher has been easy and lovely and happy from day one. All he does is bring joy into our lives. I used to laugh when he was a baby about his strategy. Okay, I'm the third kid. I'll just be as good as I can and hope someone pays attention to me. Wow, has that worked. Thatcher is smart as a whip, with a great sense of humor. He loves to smile and laugh with us all, and is already picking up his Nana Linda's bluntness. Once I was putting him to bed and singing him songs, he asked for something special, so I tried a couple outside of my comfort zone. Carly Simon was in there. Let's just say they weren't exactly in my key. I quickly moved on to an old reliable, Amazing Grace. Much better. Thatcher and I shared a loving glance. Or so I thought. Then he asked me, why were the first two songs not very good? He's got the same loving nature as his big brother and sister. He'll let me hold him for 5 minutes straight in a full-on embrace. He'll bury his face in my chest and comes over often, looking for a hug. He looks out for his siblings, too. If Yates skins his knee, you'll hear Thatcher say, you're okay, Yatesy. Do you need a cookie to make you feel better? It's possible I am repeating my mother's promotion of emotional eating. He's got impressive confidence for someone so young. We had this exchange just the other day. Thatch, you were kind of whiny this morning. I know you can do better than that. We'll talk about that in 1 minute, Mom. First, I would like you to read me this book. He's two! I'm still the number one person Thatcher wants to be with at any point in the day, which makes me feel like I've won the lottery. We have a strong connection. Thatcher, I asked him one day, are you a boy or a girl? I'm a boy, he said. What about Yates? Yatesy's a boy, he said. How about Yards? Yardley's a grill, which is how he pronounces girl right now. Love that. What about Mommy? I asked him. Mommy's a cowgirl, he answered. See, that kid gets me. One quick note on my kids' grown-up names, which people often comment on. Yates was named after his grandfather's, Edward Yates Brunt. My father's given first name was Edward. Manly Yates Brunt was Doug's father's name. We loved Yates as a nickname. Once you have a son named Yates and you get pregnant, where do you go from there? You can't very well go from Yates to Anne. You have to find a strong name again. Now, I'll confess to being a big fan of the 1945 Barbara Stanwyck film Christmas in Connecticut, a movie in which there's a character named Alexander Yardley, played by Sidney Greenstreet. But this is not exactly the type of character after which you name a sweet baby girl. So I wasn't actively calling upon those memories when I thought of her name. The truth is, it came to me in the middle of the night, late in my pregnancy. I woke Doug up and said, honey, I think I have it. By the time our third child was born, we were pretty attached to the last name is first name thing. Margaret Thatcher had recently died, so the name was in the air. But I get that plenty of people think my kids' names are unusual. Not long after Yates was born, this was driven home by an elderly woman who lived a floor below us. One day, as a new mom, I was in the elevator with Yates in the stroller when she got on. What's his name? She said. Yates. Yates? Is that his first name or his last name? It's his middle name, I said, but that's what we call him. She frowned. It's very confusing. Fast forward 1 year. Now I'm in the elevator with Yardley in the stroller and Yates in the baby Bjorn. Is that a new baby? The old woman says. Yes. What's her name? Yardley. She responded. All I have to say is, thank God we were out of the building by the time Thatcher was born, or she might have called social services on me for name abuse. Chapter 17. Ready for Prime Time. When I announced that I was expecting another baby, hell if I didn't get promoted again. Roger was offering me the 9 o'clock p.m. show. It was the first change to the channel's evening lineup in 17 years. What a chance they took on me. In July 2013, Thatcher was born. In October, so was the Kelly file. My executive producer, Tom Lowell, and I were ready for primetime. It was the pinnacle of cable news, my own primetime broadcast. We launched it the way all news programs should be launched, with an impromptu dance party to the NXS song, Don't Change. At first, it was just me dancing around my staff about 20 minutes before airtime. Their faces reflected an internal monologue of, well, this is awkward. But then Abby and Tom got into it, and pretty soon everyone was on their feet. A few minutes later, I was sitting at the anchor desk interviewing Ted Cruz, asking him my very first question as host of The Kelly File. What's it like to be the most hated man in America? I think as an anchor, I have stayed true to that full playfulness spectrum, the 1980s rock to Ted Cruz scale. When I got my own show, O'Reilly gave me advice. He warned me that primetime cable news is a snake pit, and I would have to gird myself for acrimony. This was unfortunate news, since acrimony was one of the main things I hated about my law job. Of course, I had already felt some of it while on America Live, but he seemed to be saying, brace yourself. Once my show started, I kept doing The Factor, because I was loyal to Bill. It was tough because Bill tapes his show earlier in the day, and mine is live at 9 p.m., so doing The Factor meant leaving my kids at the only time of day I could really see them. Still, I continued my weekly Factor appearances for 2 years after The Kelly File began. Once I got to primetime, things changed between us, in that I became Bill's competitor, rather than an afterthought marooned in the afternoon. But that's what happens with competitive people. They want to win, and it can create a different dynamic. I know I owe a lot to Bill, and I'll always be grateful for the help he gave me before anyone knew who I was, not to mention the terrific lead-in he gives me. I was thrilled to be able to make my mark in primetime, to spread my wings and do things my own way. I wanted to create a healthy work environment, one where people wanted to come to work each day, where people felt valued, not threatened or ignored. We put up inspirational posters around my team's pod, bought a high-end coffee maker, set up weekly office hours for the team to come and see me, and created a Kelly File rewards program where people would be recognized for outstanding work. Look, it's not exactly Google, but we make an effort. We try to do fun things out of the office together. Parties in Central Park or around the holidays, drinks after the show on a particularly challenging night. All of this has fostered a familial kind of relationship among us and raises the bar for new hires on the show. As my mom likes to say, life is too short to surround yourself with unhealthy people. As for content, we wanted to look and feel different. I am not an ideologue, nor am I a pundit like Bill and Sean around me. I'm a news anchor who has come out publicly as an independent. I wanted a show that would surprise people, enlighten them, a show that would be easy to consume but compelling to watch, as we describe it, like cool water over a hot brain. If we nail an unusually dense segment, we'll say to each other, cool water. One of my goals on The Kelly File has been to bring on newsmakers who no one else is challenging, to mix it up, to fact-check people, to set the record straight. In this vein, one of the most satisfying interviews I've done to date on the show was with Bill Ayers, the domestic terrorist who belonged to the radical left Weathermen, later known as the Weather Underground. Ayers is married to Bernadine Dorn, who was once on the FBI's most wanted list. Ayers would later defend Dorn, saying, a lot of great people have been on that list. I'm sure she's a peach. During the 2008 election, it was reported that Barack Obama launched his career in Bill Ayers' living room. That was a little inflated. They were both in Chicago and in the same social justice circles, and Ayers had a cocktail party for the then-aspiring politician. But the reason Ayers was such a good candidate for our show was that he had been all over the news, and no one had really held him to account until we came along. Ayers and his group had terrorized the country in protest against the Vietnam War. They planted bombs in places like the Pentagon, the U.S. Capitol, and the State Department. And when one went off unexpectedly in a New York City townhouse, it killed four of their own. They were accused by the San Francisco Police Union of killing a cop. They terrorized a judge and his family with pipe bombs in the middle of the night. The list goes on. And then they wound up as college professors, because why not? Who else would these institutions so offended by conservatives like Condi Rice, Ben Shapiro, and Dick Cheney, even speaking for a night on campus, invite to teach full-time? Folks like Kathy Boudin, who helped kill two police officers in 1981, served 20-plus years for murder, and is now an adjunct professor at Columbia University. Or Dorn, the Weather Underground leader who celebrated the Charles Manson murders, including that of the 9 months pregnant Sharon Tate, saying, "Dig it. First they killed those pigs, and then they put a fork in Pig Tate's belly. The weathermen dig Charles Manson." She went on to teach at Northwestern Law School, one of the best schools in the country. And her husband, Ayers, spent his post-terrorist life teaching at the University of Illinois in Chicago. Is it me or is this a problem? A quick note on what's happening on our college campuses these days. Some in the younger generation today seem determined to shut down any opinions that don't happen to match their own, typically progressive, values. I believe this is not only boneheaded, but bad for us as a society. We are becoming what I have dubbed a cupcake nation, trying to eliminate offensive or even differing viewpoints, and with them, our grit and resilience. I'm a big First Amendment advocate, and I do what I can to call attention to the attacks on it, whether it's the "we can't function if exposed to unpleasant language" college kids who need a safe space to discuss any social issue, or the universities writ large who want to banish all speech that doesn't quite line up with their values. I believe in the right to offend, to insult, even to horrify. It's not that we're supposed to enjoy it, it's that we're supposed to allow it, and then respond in a more persuasive voice. That's the bedrock of the First Amendment. The answer to speech you do not like is not less speech, it's more speech. In addition to defending the free speech rights of the vile Westboro Baptist Church, I've also defended the free speech rights of Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who comes on The Kelly File, among very few other shows. She's a Somalian human rights activist who underwent genital mutilation as a young girl, as mandated by her Islamic faith. Hirsi Ali has since become an outspoken critic of Islam and is under a death threat by Islamic extremists. Still, she bravely speaks out. Amazingly, some American universities and critics would like to silence her. Yes, she has said some controversial things about Islam, but the First Amendment exists to protect controversial speech, not speech we love that ruffles no feathers. Hirsi Ali deserves her say, and when a critic tried to silence her on my show, I shot back at him, "When you undergo genital mutilation, you may have a thing or two to say about it." I was also vocal in my defense of Pamela Geller, a controversial figure who held a Draw Muhammad contest and then faced an attempt on her life by radical Muslims. Others, including Trump, blamed Geller, saying she had essentially invited her own attempted murder. I maintained that Geller's behavior was at the heart of the First Amendment, especially given its provocative nature. Unlike Hirsi Ali, Ayers was not banned from college campuses. Instead, he was revered on them. Another reason why my sit-down with him was perhaps the most compelling thing I've done on television. For decades, Ayers had been allowed to pass himself off as nothing more than a Vietnam War protester who set off a few explosive devices and no one got hurt. Nonsense. He terrorized people, including children. His group committed murder. Some academic types were so determined to reward him for his opposition to the war that he was given a relative pass for years. But he did not get a pass on The Kelly File, nor was he allowed to dodge and weave with his usual retorts of, "No one was hurt." Yes, they were. New York Times columnist and all-around ballbuster Maureen Dowd pulled me aside at an event years later and said of the Ayers exchange, "That's when I knew you were a great journalist. Great." Like most human beings, I love positive feedback, especially from people I respect. But what I really loved about that moment was it showed how the Ayers interview had penetrated beyond our typical audience. Of course, Bill Ayers wasn't the kind of person likely to show up on Fox News. Hannity, to his credit, had been attempting to shine a light on Ayers in the weeks leading up to the 2008 election because of the alleged Ayers-Obama connection. But those questions were largely dismissed. Dinesh D'Souza, a guest on The Kelly File, had interviewed Ayers for a movie D'Souza had made called America, Imagine the World Without Her, about American exceptionalism and those who reject it. We had booked D'Souza for a July 4th special, but needed someone to argue against him. He told me privately, "I think I can get heirs for you." Sure enough, he did it. I couldn't believe my eyes when Ayers walked in the door. We hit him in the building like he was Justin Bieber at a middle school prom. We knew someone would try to poach him, and we couldn't let that happen. So we stuck him in a part of the basement no one uses at Fox, under the dutiful watch of two staffers. Lo and behold, at the appointed hour, Bill Ayers walked onto my set. He sat down across from me, and what a moment. The next hour between us was extraordinary television. I worked very hard to prepare for that day. I had read up on Ayers, his group, and their crimes, both alleged and proven, for weeks. My team and I had read his books, listened to his radio interviews, you name it. There were many late-night meetings with my staff, who were as committed as I was to making sure we had our facts straight. We had located riveting clips of him, and he had written about much of it in his book, though clearly he had forgotten some of what he'd said. For example, he denied that the Weather Underground bombed the home of Judge John Murtaugh, where Murtaugh's 9-year-old son was sleeping. I confronted Ayers with a passage from his own book. 2 weeks before the townhouse explosion, 4 members of this group had firebombed Judge Murtaugh's house in New York. "I didn't write that," said Ayers, caught flat-footed. "It's in your book," I countered, with a graphic ready and on the screen. There was no way out for him. The audience knew. We followed up later on in the show with the little Murtaugh boy, now all grown up, to describe what it was like to wake up to his home being bombed and to respond to Ayers' claims about no one ever getting hurt. We also had on FBI agents and NYPD officers who had investigated Ayers' many crimes and who explained why they were convinced he had perpetrated not just the bombings, but also many other crimes. For the first time, Bill Ayers was fully outed. It was a service to the truth. The interview was picked up everywhere. People began clamoring for their own Ayers interviews. He granted one to a far-left website, saying about me, "She's like a cyborg constructed in the basement of Fox News. She's very striking, but very metallic. Very cold. Her eyes are very cold." Ayers was the gift that kept on giving. I responded to that with a humorous bit on our show, in which I showed a picture of my eyes looking lovingly at Doug in an interview Doug had done on The Kelly File, and then a shot of me looking stonily at Ayers, suggesting that my coldness might have had something to do with the man in front of me. The Ayers interview put The Kelly File on the map as dynamic, different, hard-hitting journalism. It garnered enormous ratings, and Fox ran it and reran it again and again for months. Not long after that, in September 2014, I landed an exclusive interview with another infamous and reclusive professor, Ward Churchill. Churchill was a professor of ethnic studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. He had written an essay in 2001 called "Some People Push Back" on the justice of roosting chickens, in which he called those murdered in the Twin Towers on 9/11 "Little Eichmanns," Nazi Adolf Eichmann having orchestrated the Holocaust and been executed for it. Lest you think he was quoted out of context, here's more of that paragraph. "True enough, there were civilians of a sort, but innocent? Give me a break. They formed a technocratic core at the very heart of America's global financial empire. If there was a better, more effective, or in fact any other way of visiting some penalty befitting their participation upon the little Eichmanns inhabiting the sterile sanctuary of the Twin Towers, I'd really be interested in hearing about it." This was protected speech, no doubt. The college was a public university, and he was a tenured professor. Except in very limited circumstances, the First Amendment doesn't allow a government body, like a public school, to punish someone for the content of their speech. Still, the school, under pressure from its alumni, found an excuse to cut him loose. He tried suing, but with mixed results. On The Kelly File, I pressed him on his outlandish statements about the 9/11 victims. He did not dial them back, and at one point became slightly threatening. The interview was tense. I was strong with him as he continued to condemn America and to argue that we deserved the 9/11 attacks and more. Do you believe the United States ought to be bombed? I asked. I think the United States, by its own rules, is subject to being bombed, he answered. You can't answer the question. Yeah, I have answered the question. I say the United States should comply with law. Yes or no, do we deserve to be bombed? If it does not comply with law, it opens itself up to it. Why can't you have the courage to just answer honestly? Yes or no, do we deserve to be bombed? Just say it if you think it's true, I pressed. Churchill leaned forward, across the anchor desk a bit, slightly but noticeably in my space. He lowered his baritone voice. He was angry. I wondered where this was going. I did not budge. I say that if you open yourself up, under rule of law, for reciprocation in kind, it's quite likely going to happen. I will say that at that point, no more than a murderer who's convicted and punished, you have no complaint. That's what I say. Again, this was electric television. For the record, I am not this prosecutorial in all of my interviews. Only when someone says something as outlandish as that the 9/11 victims deserved it, or that bombing private homes in which little boys are asleep is a harmless crime. As I mentioned, I had also had some epic on-air battles with then-Congressman Anthony Weiner. I challenged him on his positions, and he treated me with disdain. We had some robust and widely circulated exchanges, including on the Kelly file. In 2011, Weiner was outed for sending lewd texts, including naked pictures of himself, to random women on the internet. I was on maternity leave with Yardley when it happened. He had just sent me a handwritten congratulations note on her birth. Despite the contentious interviews we had had, I felt bad for him. I typically feel uncomfortable judging what people do in their relationships. That's not to say we should have no moral standards as a society, but I was taught that those standards must include forgiveness, that we are all sinners. You never know what goes on in somebody's marriage. That's not to excuse Weiner's conduct. An inappropriate internet relationship is a form of cheating. Beyond that, he had to know in his position as a U.S. congressman that this kind of intimate exchange with random women he had met online was an incredibly reckless act. Weiner was nearly ruined by the scandal. And then, an amazing thing happened. The public seemed ready to forgive him. His wife, Hillary Clinton's right-hand woman, Huma Abedin, stood by him. She clearly loved him. What's more, she took wedding vows, was expecting his child, and wanted it to work. I think her choices helped the public look past his mistakes. But then Weiner ran for New York City mayor, and it came out that he had continued the illicit behavior even after he'd been caught and done his apology rounds and been forgiven. This was a bridge too far, and in the mayoral election, he wound up getting less than 5% of the vote. There was only so much the public could look past. I understand that, too. As luck would have it, I was on my next maternity leave with Thatcher when Weiner's mayoral race scandal broke in 2013. Even though most people thought I would have loved to cover Weiner's downfall, I felt relieved I didn't have to. Don't get me wrong, part of me felt a smidge of satisfaction that someone who had been quite rude to me had fallen from grace. Still, I get uncomfortable with the level of zeal our society brings to the downfall of the mighty in this country, particularly when it's due to a personal failing as opposed to a political breach. This same reticence manifested in our coverage, or lack thereof, of the deeply troubled Canadian politician Rob Ford. We barely covered the story, even when those around us in the TV universe were leading with it night after night. That story, at its heart, was about drug addiction. It was a made-for-TV tale in some ways. The things he was doing were so outrageous. Some TV hosts openly laughed at him. While I've never tried drugs, I know people who have struggled with addiction, and it is far from a laughing matter. It's like having a nuclear bomb go off in your life and your family's lives. What we were seeing was the self-destruction of a man who was failing to conquer a disease that has burdened so many. The ratings gold the story provided simply was not worth it. When Rob Ford died of cancer in 2016, I was glad we had never added to his public shaming. I am not naive. I understand that public shaming is often what we do for a living in the news business. A sitting president has an affair with an intern in the Oval Office and then lies about it under oath? Of course, the press is going to pounce on that. But the glee the media and the public seem to experience in consuming each other's personal embarrassments is disheartening to me. I do my best to avoid these celebrations of destruction where I can. I think my viewers notice. I have received thousands of notes from fans of the show, but only one is posted on my office bulletin board, from a viewer named Linda, written in silver. Thank you so much. Sharing news that does not create more resentment takes great style. When NBC's Brian Williams had his fall from grace, we adopted the same approach. His serial exaggerations were a story, no question, but not something we needed to hammer every night. I made sure always to give voice to his explanation when we discussed it, and whenever I was asked about him publicly, I defended the belief in second chances. Did I think he could return to the evening news chair on NBC? No. But should his entire career be over? No. It wasn't as if he'd been actively hurting people. Some seemed to express glee that he had embarrassed himself. I'm not saying it wasn't a story. I'm saying I hate how we forget about our subjects' humanity in reporting these stories. These are human beings. So many anchors cover these stories and won't even put on a guest to defend the person being attacked. They choose two attack dog guests and tear the subject limb from limb, seemingly with glee. I can't stand this. It shows no understanding of the power of our microphones, no appreciation for the responsibility we have. TV, especially cable news, is not unlike the seventh grade group in that way. Once a person has been identified as a target, the group smells weakness and pounces. If someone does something newsworthy or a public figure falls, it's fine to cover it. But we must also remember that behind every story, there are real men and women trying to live their lives. Many have spouses, and often children. Some hosts don't care. They want scorched earth and take no prisoners TV. I did that as a lawyer, and that's not how I want to live anymore. Now I want to be curious and honest, without transforming myself into a carnival barker. Years after the Wiener Does It Again scandal, Doug and I ran into Anthony and Huma on the Upper East Side. They were sitting on a bench outside of a coffee shop. She had a big smile. She looked happy, relaxed. The four of us had a great conversation about our kids and New York City schools. I thought, this is the Anthony Wiener she knows. This is the man who wrote me that card after Yardley was born. The man who brought himself into ill repute, but who is still a husband, a father, and a human being on this earth. And then he did it again, sending a woman erotic photos of himself, including one with his sleeping child next to him on his bed. Huma left him, and all I could think about was her smiling face that day on the bench and the sometimes inescapable cruelty of human nature. Since launching The Kelly File, which is now the most successful news show in all of cable, O'Reilly's is an opinion program, I have been asked many times how I managed to excel in what is still a male-dominated industry. The truth is, every industry in which I've ever worked has been controlled by men, from retail stores to customer service to health clubs, restaurants, law firms, and now television. So I've had a lot of experience. Generally, my bosses have been male. Generally, they've also been supportive, fair, and more than ready to give any deserving employee an opportunity to advance, male or female. Having said that, I am an American woman born in 1970. Of course, I've also experienced sexism and even sexual harassment, and I have some thoughts on how to navigate both. My feeling on the subject of women's equality is that it's better to show than tell. I believe in the Steve Martin mantra, "Be so good they can't ignore you." I have an enormous poster of this saying in my team's pod at Fox. When it comes to living this just be better philosophy, Oprah is my role model. In her years coming up, she never made a thing of her gender or her race. She just wowed us all. That's my goal. Do the absolute best I can and don't waste time complaining. The less time talking about our gender, the better. In all the years I've worked at Fox, I have never had to ask for a promotion. I have been asked what I think is the next step for me, and I've never been shy to answer. So many broadcasters line up outside the boss's office, asking for this show or that one. I've spent my time in my own office, working night and day, and opportunity came to me. Most of my own power has come from excellence, not advocacy. My approach is to say to myself, just do better, be better. That's not to say there's no bias, no sexism. There is, and it's not good. It's just that for me, the solution of doing better is far more empowering than lamenting one's circumstances. It's not that I reject the idea of demanding a place at the table. Quite the contrary. But in my experience, the most effective way to get opportunities is with performance, not persistence. Hard work matters. I really believe that. It can get you on the law review, on the moot court team, on the partnership track, in the anchor chair. It can improve your friendships, your relationships, yourself. But you can't half-ass it. And sitting around convincing yourself that you deserve more without busting your backside to get it is not only bad form, it's pointless. I've never worked at a place where some star employee, man or woman, was unknown to everyone, toiling away unnoticed. If you believe this is happening to you, ask yourself if you have worked as hard as possible, studied extensively, and made yourself invaluable. If you can't honestly say you have done all of those things, quit complaining. "I don't feel valued," a coworker once said to me. "That's because you're not," I said. "You should go somewhere else." I saw no reason to sugarcoat it. Kelly family values in their purest form. Settle for more. Many people choose to work less hard and to prioritize something else. That's great. My point is simply, if your goal is to rise to the top of your company and it's not happening, you must look first at your own work ethic and work product before assuming it's gender bias. Like most American women, I have been interrupted frequently by male colleagues who don't do the same to men at the table. I have been checked out physically by more than a few bosses. I have found myself excluded from the boys-only nights out at the bar at which bonding with a superior takes place. Do men sometimes get a leg up at work because they have access to male supervisors that women don't have? Absolutely. You cannot control that. But you can control you. Employers want to improve the bottom line. You may not get invited to the bar with the boys, but do better, be better, and the odds are the hungover boys will soon be asking themselves how you keep getting such great opportunities. My general approach when hitting a sexist glass ceiling is to try to crash right through it with stellar work product. Bosses tend to be mercenary. If you're great, he'll likely promote you. If he doesn't because of sexism, the options get tougher. Filing a legal complaint is a potential option, but gender discrimination cases tend to be protracted and very nasty. Some women choose to find a new job, as unfair as that seems. The choices are fraught with peril, which is exactly why many women resign themselves to operating in a sexist workplace, hoping that with time, things will get better. Sexual harassment is even more dangerous. Interrupting you because you're a woman is one thing. Trying to shove a tongue down your throat is another. Unfortunately, I've been there, too. When I was 16 and clueless about the world, Kelly and I took a job at a local sporting goods shop. Our boss was a dirty old man. He used to walk by and look at my ass when I was restocking shelves and say, "Are you sure you're only 16? He was always telling me and Kelly how he was going to take us back on Old Reliable, a ski-waxing machine where one could ostensibly lie down. When we were cleaning up at the end of the day, he would watch porn on a TV in the back. We laughed at him. He was a joke to us. And eventually, we both quit. I know very few women who don't have stories like this. Remember, I practiced employment law. What I learned was that some men are absolutely still doing the things you heard would happen in the 1950s. You would not believe how many bosses are still grabbing their employees' breasts or leaving X-rated images on their assistant's chair or chasing their young female employees around the desk. It happens all the time. And it needs to stop happening. Now. Chapter 18 on Having It All. I own an oversized green T-shirt with "I Want It All" emblazoned on the front. One time, while we were visiting my mother-in-law, Jackie, I emerged from the bedroom wearing that shirt and carrying Thatcher, who was still a baby. It was some ridiculously early hour. I had been up late the night before with Yardley, who was sick. I had just come off a week of long hours at the office. My eyes had dark circles under them. My hair was everywhere. It felt like I hadn't slept in a century. Jackie looked from me, rocking my baby, to the front of that shirt and back again and said, "Oh, you've got it all right." And I do. My own show, a great husband, three beautiful kids I love more than words can say. Now I just have to survive to the end of the week. Sometimes on particularly rough days, I say, "Doug, am I going to make it? This might be the week I get the chalk outline around me." "Eh, you'll make it," he says. We're in a particularly good place now. Ages 6, 5, and 2 are a sweet spot. Way better than 3, 2, and newborn. Way better. Back then, I used to slide into my car and say to myself, "Time to go to that spa they call work." Okay, I still do that from time to time. We have resources now, which clearly makes things easier. Some moms don't like to admit having a nanny or other support. I don't understand why. Every dollar I have, I've earned. I pay my taxes, donate to charity, help my family, and am saving for my children. My hard work has helped us afford household help, which allows us the luxury of spending time with our children when we are not at work, rather than tending to all of the household tasks. But if we could not afford help, we'd figure it out. I'm new to money. I spent most of my existence without it. I know how to live frugally. If we were to lose it all tomorrow, we would change our hours, move out of the city, and make other adjustments, just like my parents did. Money removes many stressors, but it has not changed my level of happiness, nor who I am. It changes how I spend my time. Right now, I work at night, so my time with the kids during the week is mostly during the day. We socialize mostly with the parents of our children's friends. I can chaperone daytime field trips. I go into my son's school and read to his class during library. I go to most of the school parties and all of the plays. I miss plenty of events too, which pains me, but every working parent makes sacrifices. Our mornings involve enormous mugs of coffee, Cheerios, fruit, plenty of stories, and music via Pandora. We dance. We feed the fish, which I did not want to buy, but which, in the absence of any other caretakers, now appear to be mine. I do not like fish and take care of them only begrudgingly, but the truth is, I'm getting kind of attached to the damn things. I help the kids get breakfast. They eat a lot in the mornings, so Doug and I often feel like short-order cooks. "One scrambled, one fried with cheese, double wheat coming up." I help pick out the kids' outfits, although that's really more of an attempt to block Doug from doing it. He'll see me cast a disapproving eye at Yardley's outfit when she's not looking. "What's wrong with it?" he'll say of the outfit he chose. "It matches." "It does match," I'll say, "in that a polka-dot pair of pants matches a polka-dot shirt." It's better just to beat him to the closet. Soon she'll be in kindergarten, and I'm delighted to say they wear uniforms at her school. Now I can sleep in a few more minutes. Weekends are all about them. We don't make it to church every Sunday, though we do our best. Doug grew up Presbyterian, but like me, all of our children have been baptized Catholic. Yates will have his first communion next year. Our priest is Father Jonathan Morris, who is on Fox News sometimes. He's supportive, thoughtful, and good-looking. So handsome, in fact, that his nickname around the studio is "Father, what a waste. God forgive us." I'm most exhausted on Sunday nights because you have to dig deep to keep up with three kids nonstop. Luckily, they're very good kids. That makes time with them very pleasant. I remember talking to an administrator at Yates' school. I said, "I love spending time with him. He's one of my favorite people. He's the best company." "Not everybody feels that way," she said to me. That was the first time it dawned on me that some parents and kids struggle with each other, even at young ages. Now sometimes I see it on the playground. Families who don't love their time together, and it's heartbreaking. I mean, is it hard sometimes? Of course. But I'll tell you, the first time you tuck your baby into his crib and say, "Sweet dreams, I love you," and you turn to walk out and hear back, "I love you, Mama," you know what you're doing on this earth. One day, I was feeling full of self-doubt, wondering if I was doing this motherhood thing right. Just then, Yeats looked at me and Doug and announced, "I am going to marry a girl named Megan. She's alive and she's 5, and I need to find her. Thank you, universe." Balancing motherhood with work has been hugely assisted by having a husband who supports my time at the office and a job that allows for my time at home. I'll start with the office. First, I have something critical to balancing my dual roles: flexibility in my schedule. Unlike the law, my TV job rarely requires 12 or 16 hours at the office. Some days I can do 6 hours, some days a split shift. If I need to come in late, I can. If I need to work from home, except for airtime, it's generally no problem. That's been incredibly helpful to me. Without this kind of freedom, I don't think I'd be succeeding. I also was fortunate enough to feel supported at work right after my children were born. And I had nice long maternity leaves, by American standards, for which I was not shamed and, to the contrary, was encouraged to take. I nursed all 3 of my children for the first year and exclusively for the first 6 months of their lives. It took time and dedication, what with all of that pumping and late-night feeding, but I was happy to do it. It was another way to take care of them, even when I was at the office. Now that they're older, the kids come to work with me fairly often, and my colleagues help, especially Abby. We have office picnics. We get pizza and chocolate milk, and they run up and down the long hallways. They're city kids. We have no fields. Everyone greets the kids warmly. It's not uncommon to see people's children at Fox. My kids love coming to work with me. They love going to the tracking booth. They put the headphones on and speak into the fuzzy microphones for ages, stream of consciousness style. Yeats and Yards have heard me say lines like, "I'm Megyn Kelly, live in New York." The first time Yeats tried it, he said into the mic, "I'm Yeats Brunt, and I'm alive." They don't usually come to see me do the show, because 9 o'clock p.m. is too late for them. But if I'm doing a pre-tape, they'll come sometimes and sit off to the side, so long as I'm not talking about anything too dark, like terror. My crew will show them the cameras and let them sit at the anchor desk. My hair and makeup team, Chris and Vincenza, will give them spiked hair and painted faces. It's like going to a street fair. I think it's good for them to see their mother in a powerful position where she is clearly in control. I'm glad they will grow up to understand, inherently, that women loving their work is a natural thing in this world. When possible, I look for opportunities to take my children with me when I go on the road for work. When Yeats graduated from preschool, I took him